All right, boys, here we go there. And we're going to auction off the rooster. The committee of the whole will please come to order. All right. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 101. Reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 101, introduced by Senator Coe, an act relating to the Hathaway Student Scholarship Program. This bill was referred to number 4, Education, which recommended a due pass with amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Burkhart, Connolly, Freeman, Croker, Crone, Laux, Madden, Teeter, sign representing Teeter's chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Teeters?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File 101 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. I will walk you briefly through the bill with the Standing Committee Amendment, and then we'll call for the question at the appropriate time. Senate File 101 deals with the Hathaway Student Scholarship Program. Currently, under the Opportunity, Performance, and Honors Scholarship, you are only eligible to use your Hathaway scholarship at a community college for 2 years. This bill would change that so that you could use any number of semesters of eligibility at any community college. What we've discovered is that there are programs that are currently offered in the community colleges that sometimes take more than 2 years worth of eligibility, and currently, you cannot use your Hathaway scholarship. The Standing Committee Amendment on page 2, line 16, deletes the language which leads to a professional degree. We felt that that language was too restrictive, and that if a student is still trying to find their way and discover who they are at the community college, it's a whole lot cheaper to do it there, even if they are not necessarily declared into a professional degree. So I would call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment.
You've heard the question being called. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if there aren't any questions, I would be happy to entertain questions on the bill. But if there aren't any, I would call for the question on the bill.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Teeter's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 101 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
Senate File 101 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to request a privilege of the floor momentarily.
Please proceed.
Ladies and gentlemen, in our south balcony, we are joined by Mr. Oscar Yildiz, who is the president of the West American Turkic Council. You may recall that you recently received an invitation from the West America Turkic Council to attend a reception and dinner next Thursday night at Little America. Mr. Yildiz and members of his delegation are going to be in the lobby for the next hour or so to answer any questions you may have about the event. He's also available to discuss goals of his organization to promote intercultural dialogue between Wyoming, Turkish Americans, and the Republic of Turkey. Please welcome him.
We will stand at ease for just a moment, please. Okay, the next bill for our consideration will be Senate File number 106. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 106, introduced by School Finance, an act relating to school finance local resources. This bill was sent to Committee number 2, Appropriations, which recommended a due pass. Ayes, Berger, Edmonds, Escobel, Harshman, no, Stewart, Wallace, excused, Pedersen, signed, representing Berger, chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Berger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 106 do pass. And I will begin the explanation. There will be a kind of a team tag effort on this, Mr. Chairman. And also, I know you're getting inundated with paper, but I just can't get out of my appropriations mode. And so I just want to make certain that you all have a colored current cash flow handout. You have a copy of the statutes that have the date 1998 on it. And then some of you have seen it, but we have also a highlight of the bill and a four-page legal handout attached to that. So hopefully, as the different speakers discuss this bill, you will have the information that is needed for you to walk through the bill. And the first thing that I would like to do is just bring forward then that this is the School Finance Local Resources Bill. It was brought to us during the School Finance Recalibration Select Committee work that took place this summer. This is really about the inequities of the state wealth and how it's distributed amongst the 48 school districts. And so what this proposal does is it diverts the funding in a more constant manner. And if you just look at really lines 1 through 4, diverting certain revenues available for the public schools directly to the Public School Foundation program account for distribution to districts. The important highlights on how we collect the monies and then how they are distributed and how we ask those funds to be redeposited. I would recommend that on pages 11 through 13, this is where we direct the county treasurer to transfer the school mill levy collections directly to the state school account. And then on page 19, the schools receive the payments on a monthly basis. And right now is when I've got some other folks that will help us walk through the distribution method that we use currently, what we're proposing in Senate File 106, and then the differences that that would create with that. So that's what takes place on page 19 in creating those payments monthly. And then on page 14, what we're doing is it's how the state treasurer then redeposits those funds or redistributes those funds back to our districts and to local banks on that. Mr. Chairman. And at this time, I will defer to the Chairman of Education.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to walk us through real briefly the constitutional concerns that we all have with the current system that we've got. Going back many years, the Supreme Court has made it clear that the funding of education cannot be a function of local wealth, and we've been through several lawsuits that have established that. This principle has been established for over 30 years, but in 1995, the Supreme Court declared the entire school system of funding unconstitutional because it remained based on local wealth. That was the decision that we got in Campbell 1. The legislature has since then embarked on a 15-year journey to correct these constitutional issues. The guarantee of funding to each school district is now based on our complicated block grant funding model that we walked through the other day when we did the recalibration bill, and additional categorical funding that is provided through this legislature. This is one of the last vestiges of the old system of funding that is based on the concepts of recapture and entitlement. Revenues are generated at the local level and are currently held by the local districts until they're spent or they're recaptured if there is an excess at several points throughout the year. The entitlement districts, because they do not have enough local revenue for all of their needs, are supplemented through the foundation program account. These districts thus don't have a whole lot of extra funds available at any given time. The recapture districts, on the other hand, because they bring in more local revenue than their guarantee from the state, have quite a lot of extra funds available for larger portions of the year. The recapture districts are able to invest those extra funds, and they earn interest on those local funds, and they are used they use that interest without being credited against them as a local resource. Something that's considered, all other funds to the districts are considered local resources, and we actually account for that when we send them their block grant funds and decrease that amount so that they are made whole, but they don't get the extra. But in this situation, the interest earned on that extra money is not counted as a local resource. Additional interest earned on these recapture districts are not available to the entitlement districts, which are most of us are considered entitlement districts, and thus there is an inequity in the system that is driven by local wealth. The constitutional concern that we have and that other people that have examined this have is based on the mandate that we received in Campbell 1 from our friends in black coats across the street. A valid legal argument appears to exist that allows the recapture districts of this additional funding, which is based on local wealth, and is inequitable because it denies school children of the entitlement districts of the same benefit. On the converse, we also have a situation where there are several districts in the state of Wyoming that do not have enough revenue to get them to their next entitlement payment, and they're actually supplementing loans that they have to take out from the local districts, and when they do that, they're pulling money out of their block grants to pay for the interest when they borrow the money. So we've got people at the top that are essentially able to invest that money, and they're receiving hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of interest that the other districts are not allowed to have because they are not afforded the same opportunity because they're not recapture districts. And then we have the districts that are having to borrow money from their local banks, and that essentially is the inequality that we've got. It is our belief that if challenged in court, the position that we have right now is undefensible, and that we will most certainly lose, and when we do, the court will mandate the system that we are proposing or one similar to it. So it's imperative to keep us out of another lawsuit. And the other concern that I have, if we are to get back into the litigation mode, is what other things might be brought up and what other areas might be questioned. I mean, it could be a Pandora's box, quite frankly, if we get back into litigation. I don't want to get into a situation where we have to reexamine the entire system and come back to this body and have to add another couple $100 million potentially because we lost another court case. So those are the constitutional concerns. And the good representative from the central part of the state will continue the conversation.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I just wanted to, I think you have some handouts in your tray. The first one is just letter size. It's two pages, color flow charts. I think those were distributed. Members, I just want to, this thing, different pictures will, I think, explain it to you. But if you look at, if you look in the middle of that first page, and where it says school foundation program account, and it shows arrows going out, and you see the recapture loans, a third of the guarantee goes to recapture districts. And then above that, entitlement payments. A third of the entitlement payments go out on August 15th. And then another third on August 15th, and another recapture loan. The first recapture loan goes out on August 15th, but does not have to be paid back until June 15th. And so you can see the entitlement payments go out in August, October and February, the top box, and the first recapture loan goes to those districts in August. So in essence, we are borrowing money to give to districts on a interest-free loan that they can make money on because they don't need that much money at the beginning for expenditures. That's the first part of this deal. And that comes at a cost. And the costs are a couple things. First is the $12 million in interest that could be used to build an elementary school or fund instructional facilitators or do whatever this body chose to do with policy. So that's a real cost. The second part of the cost is in our common school permanent fund where it was testified in our committee that their investment policy would like to put 3% of the permanent fund into liquid assets. But as a result of our current policy, where we have to borrow over $300 million a year to fund the cash flow of this at the beginning, they have to keep 12% of the common school permanent fund in liquid reserves. Therefore, we lose that difference between 12 and 3 is a 9% of our fund that could be in permanent investments where the rate of return is much higher than in the liquid cash investments. So that's the second cost, the $12 million, and then the opportunity costs on the 9% of the fund that has to remain liquid instead of permanent investments. Really, if you think about how the funds will flow, currently they flow from the local district, 6 and 25 mills, to the county, back to the district. They'll simply flow to the county, to the state, and back to the district. That's it. And they're going to flow in a little more predictable manner that is above expenses. We know that through history of looking at expenses. And so 5% in August, or in July and August, and then 9% for the remaining months. And if you look at, then I believe you have a handout. Does everyone have this in their tray, a handout on, it's legal, 3 pages of legal, the first page is letter size. I want to take you to the third page, which shows the chart, the plotted chart. And I can use this because you all have it in your tray, so I'm not using a prop. You all have this information. Folks, I think this big spike, this big green spike, those are the 9 recapture districts. Those are basically resources that are unavailable to pay for schools until the end of the year when those get settled back and paid back. That's an important point. And then I think the other point is that for the other 39 school districts, when you see the X, the red line that is above the, I believe that's purple, the triangles at the bottom, that's going to be the, under this bill, the proposed distributions, which will remain above the expenditures. So if your district says, well, I'm going to lose $50,000 in interest, that's assuming that $50,000 goes to zero. It's not going to go to zero. Districts will still be earning interest on these distributions, because in the middle of the year, there's going to be about $180 million more out in the districts than what they need for expenditures, because we're going to outpace expenditures with this distribution. You can see it in the chart as the red line continues to grow and gain space over the purple line, the expenditures. And you can see, actually, well, you can see it particularly when it peaks about in February and March, and then when districts start to get their year-end expenditures. Finally, on that handout, one more chart, ladies and gentlemen. And this is a spreadsheet divided into 3 sections. Folks, these are local district monies. You can see your school district right there. You can find your school district, and you can see the general fund cash balances. You can see the special revenue cash balances and the other fund cash balances. Right now, there's $448 million in our school district accounts. And that's not even counting this bill. It has nothing to do with this bill. That's telling you the amount of money out there. And if you do the math, there's another column in each one of those that talks about what's in the local banks. Well, you add those up, there's only about 48% of the money is actually in our local banks. And so there's a significant amount of money. The big issue, I guess, is going to be with recapture districts, because they're going to lose an advantage that they've had. And as a good chairman of education has talked, this is one of the last vestiges of fixing and cleaning up the recapture issue. And I'd urge your support, and we'd all stand for questions. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion on this bill, Chairman Berger? Nope. Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you're looking at this same chart that you were all just directed to, I want you to notice that everything above the bottom line, which is the actual expenditures, is dollars in your local banks. This is just as true for the entitlement districts as it is for the recapture districts. So, to challenge the constitutional gauntlet that has been thrown down here, I would say, why in the world would an entitlement district who has substantially more funds flowing through their local banks, giving them the liquidity that they need, the assets that they need to be able to provide loans to their local economy, substantially more than what they would be provided after this Senate file, why in the world would they ever sue for less money under their control in their local economies? I think that is unlikely to happen. So the constitutional question here, I think what this bill does, and I understand that people have worked long and hard and put a lot of work into this, but nonetheless, the constitutional question is right here at the end. At the end of this chart, you have a little bit of distance between where the red, the blue, and the burgundy lines converge, a little bit of distance between that and the recapture districts. So that's the amount of money that the recapture districts are currently able to keep as a non, or you know, out of the that's the advantage that they're gaining. That's the question here. So I don't think that any, you know, if you want to fix the constitutional question, just go back to the way it used to be, where those interest earnings were counted as a local resource. You know, the thinking behind taking away those interest, or giving them back, I guess would be the correct terminology, was that provides an incentive. So every time you see these lines going up on the recapture, that's when our tax revenues are flowing into those county coffers and being housed in our banks. And true for the entitlement districts, every time it's coming up, those are entitlement payments, or their local tax as well are being housed in their banks for short periods of time, and they're able to use that to back what goes on in their local communities. And then where you see these things falling off, that's where these counties are making their recapture payments, and it all squares out at both ends of the year. So I guess I would just have to say that I think that this is really the wrong answer to kind of a non-problem, and actually not even a very big problem that can be easily solved without this kind of pain to local economies.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to push back a little bit. We've discovered that over half of this money is not in local banks, first of all. It's in out of state. Banks have an enormous amount of money right now, and the issue is that they can't take it all, quite frankly. Second of all, I think everyone needs to ask yourself the fundamental question. Even if, assume all of the money is in the local bank, and all we're talking about doing is leveling out the way the districts receive the money. Same amount of money going to be in the districts. Same amount of money going to be in the banks, just on different intervals and in a more consistent and predictable way. But is it the foundation account's responsibility to provide the banks with liquidity anyway? And the answer is no.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the bill. I was told recently that somewhere in this bill it says the state treasurer will place money into local banks. And I guess I've tried to read this bill. It is a little confusing, but I didn't see that. The second thing I noticed on the fiscal note, corrected copy of Senate File 106, that it says the corresponding decrease in the interest revenue to the Common School Land Income Fund flowing to the school foundation program. I'm wondering why we're even paying interest back and forth between funds. Why do we have to pay interest back and forth. I don't understand why it doesn't just transfer. And then it talks about in this, these two pages, it talks about, let me just read it. By decreasing the SFP's cash flow needs, this bill will allow the state treasurer to invest the $365 million needed for borrowing in longer-term securities, allowing for the opportunity of greater total returns on the Common School Permanent Land Fund portfolio. Seems to me that means that he's going to put that into long-term securities somewhere, probably not in this state. And then it says total returns for the permanent funds are expected to be just under 7% over the long term, 10-plus years. It's been a long, long, long time since anybody has picked up 7%. If any of you younger folks in here that have savings accounts have been getting 7%, I want to know where you're doing it. Because lots of seniors at one time were getting 4 and 5 and 6%, and they're not getting that anymore. So I suspect that if you're going to get 7%, that may be a riskier area to go rather than in the local banks. 7% just sounds like an awful lot of money in this time and within the next 10 years. I don't see it. So I would urge everybody in the body to think long and hard about this bill. Maybe we're not supposed to, maybe the state is not supposed to guarantee anything to local banks, and that's probably correct. But on the other hand, we're supposed to be guaranteeing some economic development, some help in the local districts. We're giving the money from the business-ready communities. We're doing a lot of things. I'm not sure it's correct in taking money back out. On and against.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, I don't think this is about the banks. I think this is about cash flows to our school districts. It's about, equity, which is the state's wealth, not local district wealth, and really about saving money on K-12 education in the state. I mean, we had attempts to strip money out of transportation, out of special education, teacher salaries, you name it. There's been all kinds of ways to save money. I would think this would be the first $12 million you'd want to save. To think that our permanent school fund we have to borrow from to cash flow districts that have millions of dollars sitting out there that won't be paid back so they can make extra money to have advantages that most of the children in 39 other school districts don't have. That's not right. And so, really, this is about cash flow. That's a huge issue. But it's also the constitutional issue of the state's wealth. It's not about the banks. It's not about local economic development, all those other issues to try to confuse what this is all about. There are other state programs to put liquidity in our banks. It is used. I had amendments on here to force part of that $448 million of school district money, over half of which is out of state, to put that into the local banks. I was told it was too much money. Couldn't handle that much money. This is not about money in the banks. This is, again, about cash flow and about constitutionality and really about fairness because it's about the state's wealth. And we want to save money in our K-12 education. It might get real tight around here. And this would be the first $12 million that I would submit should be saved well over transportation or special ed or teacher salaries or classroom sizes. This is the low-hanging fruit here, and I encourage us to vote for it and pluck that fruit. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Varnish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've heard talk about the rich and the poor, and I don't want to do class warfare, but I really haven't made up my mind, but what I did is I called my district. And to me, it is about cash flow, and it's about timing. Now, under this new plan, they'll get 5% of the money in July and 5% in August, and then the remaining 10 months, they get 9%. Well, my district tells me that their big expenditures are in July and August when they sign their contracts with their teachers. And so they're not in favor of it. And I'd like to have someone explain to me why. It's a timing and it's a cash flow problem. So if someone could explain to me how I'm wrong, I'd really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's interesting how a bill of dealing with the school foundation programs and the rest of this and trying to cash flow everybody equally and take some of the money that gives a huge advantage, millions of dollars of advantage to certain districts over others when we're supposed to have equal distribution of these funds for according to the Supreme Court and what we've tried to do, has boiled down to a fight between the Wyoming State Legislature and the banking community. And that's what this all of a sudden become about. And I also find it interesting that we could solve the constitutional problem by saying, okay, we're gonna all the interest you earn, you're gonna have to declare that as a local resource. And for those of you that don't understand what a local resource is, that means that the state's gonna give them less money. Because that interest they're going to earn is going to say, okay, then you don't need this much money that we've been giving you because we're allowing you to keep this extra money, which you can invest in the banks. So we're going to be literally taking some of this money away from them that they've been able to put into the banks. We've got quite a dichotomy going here, guys. But the issue is, are we as the stewards of the Wyoming educational funding programs, are we going to do what we need to do to keep the state whole and the foundation money whole? It wasn't only 3 or 4 years ago that we were using general fund monies to fund education. Just 3 or 4 years ago, we were having to use general fund monies to fund education because we didn't have that much money in the school accounts. The permanent accounts. So let's get back on the issue here. We're trying to keep these accounts full. We're trying to save some money to do some of the things for the state of Wyoming. It allows the treasurer to invest and make some more money for that fund. That's what it's all about. It's not about the advantage of your particular district gets. And as to the last speaker, I'm sure there's a lot of people around here can jump up and answer that for you too.
Representative
on and for the bill.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the bill. And I'd like to point out that this chart, comparison of cumulative receipts of education resource block grant guarantee for a single fiscal year, has absolutely nothing to do with our short-term and long-term investments. This has to do with the tax revenues that are coming in to every one of your districts and when it's going out, either through recapture payments to fund the school system for the entire state or in both cases, expenditures for the school district, for the benefit of the school system. So those dollars are held in our local banks for the benefit of the school kids throughout the state, whether you're an entitlement district or a recapture district. The only advantage is the interest made on those very short-term investments for a few months of the year in between the time when our tax revenues come in and our recapture payments are made. That's a relatively small amount that I think any of us would be, to fix that problem, that's an easy, easy fix. So the difference is we are now borrowing money from ourselves, from the Common School Public Land Fund, in order to make our cash flow work out right. And then we're turning around and we're
paying it back to ourselves with interest. And then we're whining about the interest that we said we were going to charge ourselves if we had to borrow from that fund. That may be a legitimate question that we need to address. But the fact is that we're borrowing it from ourselves and paying it back to ourselves. So really, when you get down to the core of the problem, the difference is if those short-term monies are folded into the big scheme of things and they're as part of our state investment fund so that they can get the magical 7%, which many of us highly are skeptical of, most of that money is being invested in the Big Apple. Why would we do that instead of letting that money be invested in our local communities where it's benefiting the school system, where it's also benefiting our local communities?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Just to respond to a few points, first of all, I would like to say I'm speaking on and against this bill. One previous speaker said that he had contacted his school district and discovered that the real issue is cash flow and timing. And that's absolutely correct. And it's also an issue that doesn't impact very many districts in this state. It's an issue that those of you who were here last time maybe remember, I brought a really short, little two-page bill that addressed this very issue of cash flow and timing. There are about three, possibly four districts in the state that upon occasion experience cash flow issues in terms of when they get their payment versus when they have to make payroll or provide for other expenses. The idea was that if they experienced this short-term cash flow issue, they could borrow from the school foundation rather than having to secure a loan at a local bank. And the issue was not the interest. The issue was if indeed you secure such a loan, you have to be bonded. And one such school district in my part of the world had to do that, and it cost them $50,000 for the bond. That was really the genesis of this bill. That's really where it came from, was can we borrow from the school foundation account, pay it back with interest, and not have to be bonded. Now, the body decided that was a really good issue for the school recalibration committee to undertake. So they deferred it to the recalibration committee. I sat on the recalibration committee, and I saw the bill come that is now Senate File 106. And let me tell you, it bears absolutely zero resemblance to that little two-pager that I brought last year that would have addressed cash flow, would have addressed timing, would have addressed these issues by a very small number of districts. The other thing that I would like to talk about is I'm sharing some concerns presented by other speakers about this $12 million and all of this money that we're losing, all of this money that we're paying out in interest. And I had distributed, I'm sure this is just what you want, one more chart, but I had distributed one that says, a little handout that says School Foundation Program Interfund Borrowing. And this is something from the State Treasurer's Office. So if you look at it, you see that in the past, now I will tell you that historically the state has borrowed to facilitate payments under the school foundation program. But additionally, what's happened now more recently, borrowing has taken the form that's in your little handout of the school foundation program. If you look and you see the school foundation program borrowing from this common school account at a prescribed interest rate of 6%. Now, advocates of that argue that that borrowing has resulted in the school foundation program and the state incurring interest costs. But who's the recipient of these interest costs? That would be the common school account. And where do the interest earnings of the common school account go? They go to the school foundation program. It's like me borrowing money out of my savings to make sure I've got enough money in my checking account. So I'm really having trouble getting my mind around that particular argument. And the other thing I would like to remind all of us, people have been up here saying it's not about the banks, and that's absolutely right, it's not. It's about us and our local resources. The statement has been made over and over, these are state resources. I would submit to you these are local resources that have been taxed locally on our local taxpayers. These are from the mill levies that are levied by counties, by individual counties to pay to individual school districts. So basically what we are doing is we are taking that money, we are planning to give it to the state, and I'm having trouble seeing where those benefits are. It gives up our local control. I'm having trouble understanding how that is going to benefit in any small measure our kids, which I think should be our bottom line, not what's going to be of best benefit to our banks, to our districts, what's going to be of best benefit to our kids. And I would submit that that would be local use of local resources under decisions made by local personnel on and against the bill.
Chairman Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I almost forgot what it is I'm commenting on, but it goes back to a question earlier about where it would say that these funds are deposited into local banks. And it all starts with the responsibilities, of course, on page 13 on the state treasurer's responsibilities of a separate account and the deposits of monies on page 14 with little d. And then it goes to the statute 94817, which is on line 1 of page 15 at the top. And that includes specifically deposits into Wyoming banks. The other thing that's important that we heard in testimony last week was the treasurer on the time deposit open account deposits, which that amount that is available to our local banks in order for them to lend money out is at about $200 million currently. And at this time, I think about $165 million have been lent out to Wyoming banks for them to then lend out money. That amount can vary depending on the demand. We've heard it testified today that this isn't the peak time for lending, but there will be that peak time, and that's one of the concerns for local banks to have funds available to lend when the economy is in a better situation. And I believe that would be available to them right from our state treasurer and from those funds that are collected. And when you go back to the idea of consistency, I think that's critical. I think as a small business manager, having monthly payments, and if you don't use all of those funds to expend in that month, they accrue and they're then available at that peak time when you need that, when you're negotiating teacher salaries and making those big expenditures. It will be available. I mean, 15% of their operations is constantly with them locally, besides the reserves that they have for construction and other activities. So the sum is large and it is constant. Thank you.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, we're bringing up a lot of good points here, and I think everyone should listen to this very closely, because at the end of the day, you're going to have to ask yourself, are you convinced that not only is this the only way to deal with this problem, that it also has to be the best way? And of course, you would have to say that you could eliminate some of these other possible solutions that you're hearing to deal with this issue. Now, I do have a question, and I hope that I don't delay the asking of this question. And we've had some questions in some of this debate, and I think someone should be writing them down, and we should be getting some better responses. But, of course, the problem that we have today in dealing with this cash flow issue is somewhat of a self-inflicted wound, ladies and gentlemen. We have, and I'm not going to say me or you, we have collectively been very good at trying to find money to fund schools. When you look at your goldenrod, it doesn't take much. I could sit down with you and start drawing arrows. And, you know, where's Waldo? Let's follow the money here. And as it comes, from our, you know, with your revenue flow charts, where this money comes in the school foundation account. We sweep it. It goes to school CapCon. Then we set up this little account last year, kind of another little coffee can. This has all been designed so we can fund the building of schools. And why is that? Because the revenue flows for our schools, the timing of that and the predictability of that is somewhat sporadic. So all of us collectively, we've done a very good job as far as scraping some money so we can build schools. And we have exceeded expectations. When you look at our goldenrod, the beginning balance in our school CapCon, upwards of $500 million. Of course, that has contributed to, exacerbated our problem of cash flowing our school foundation account, because we've been sweeping those dollars out of the school foundation account to build schools. And not to diminish the good work of building our schools, Mr. Chairman. Now, you would hear that perhaps this is the last vestiges of Campbell. I would say this is the last crumbs on the table that we can scrape in so we can build more schools. Now, we all want to save money, and $12 million is significant. We want to deal with that. So let's talk about that $12 million. At the heart of the matter is why, and this is my question, why are we borrowing from one of our trust accounts where we are mandated to pay this high interest rate when we have other funds available or other ways through statute that we can deal with this cash flow instead of borrowing from a trust account? Of course, we don't want to borrow from that unless we can maintain that corpus and replace the money lost through our long-term investments. I would say that our rainy day account or other accounts would be adequate places to borrow this money from without having to incur a significant interest payment. And in closing, you have to ask yourself the question that was been brought up a couple of times. If, in fact, this $12 million is going to be profiled on your goldenrod, where would it show up? I would maintain it would show up twice on your goldenrod. Keep that in mind.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, the goldenrod does not show the cash flow issues from the state's perspective. I am confused by that argument. I feel a little bit like we're trying to sit on this floor and argue about who won the last Super Bowl. The Supreme Court has made it clear that funding of education cannot be a function of local wealth. We are not going to rehash that argument. It doesn't do us any good to rehash that argument. Second of all, I understand the good gentlelady's concern from Sweetwater County, and it is correct that the genesis of this conversation started when she had the concerns that she had about the cash flow situation in her district. I don't understand why she's against the bill, quite frankly. I know for a fact that Sweetwater County 1 and Sweetwater County 2 borrowed in excess of $14 million last year at a commercial rate from a local bank because they could not cash flow their district. That is the issue that we're solving with this bill. There are concerns in the body, and I understand if you come from a district where you are currently being recaptured, there is no question your district will lose local resources because of the fact that the state will recapture the money. I want everybody to be clear about that. If you are from a recaptured district, if you vote for this bill, you will see a decrease in the amount of money that your local district will receive. The issue, though, and we have to go back to the issue is not everyone has that benefit. And if we go back to the concept that the court has made it clear that funding of education is not a function of local resource, you cannot justifiably say that it's my money and I'm going to keep it, so nanny, nanny, boo-boo, okay? The issue is some districts can do it, some districts cannot, and it's not fair. We, as we started to decouple the issue of funding we discovered that you can't just simply fix it with a little float of some money to a district here or there so that somebody doesn't have to borrow money from the bank. When you dig deeper into this thing and you start to decouple it, you discover that it's got inherent problems. It is a vestige of the old system. It doesn't make any sense to continue it, and I would ask for your support of the bill.
Representative Brookery.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd like to talk about one vestige of the old system that's pretty important, and that is that the local school districts have to charge the mill levy to raise this money. And that's going to be there no matter what. Okay, we're talking here, people are saying this is a constitutional issue and this is the only way we can fix it. Well, all of you have received another attorney's opinion of whether this is constitutional or not, and it's exactly the opposite of the other attorneys. So what we have is two attorneys' opinions, and you guys have seen those before. If you look at this blue, at this table number two that was given out to all of you, here's the crux of the matter. Look on there and look at that red line that goes through there. That red line is what happens when the big government says, send all the money here and we'll decide when you get it back. That's what you get. The blue line is how you would have got it the way it stands right now. Everybody had an opportunity under that and does have an opportunity under that to make investments as they see fit, and it should stay that way. On it against the amendment, or excuse me, on it against the bill.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Real short, one more thing I just wanted to bring up. Banks have that the money, they've been talking about keep the money here and the money goes overseas and it goes back to the big apple and all these kind of things from the state. Fact of the matter is that when the banks have extra money that they can't loan out, they're either getting treasury notes, they go back to corresponding banks, they send their money off at that at very low rates of interest. Because if they can't loan it out, they have to put it to work somehow the best they can do. And usually most of those are for very short periods of time. That's why some of the interest rates are even lower. So it's not just the state treasurer that does these things. Everybody does it. Yeah, when we get into a boom, yes, there'll be a demand. And we have separate legislation that allows the state treasurer's office to put money out there to banks when they need it. But I just wanted to clear that up, that the banks also are sending money out of the state of Wyoming because they have to.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There were a couple questions. One question was about when do school districts need this money? There was some talk that maybe their biggest bills were in July and August because they signed their contracts. If you'll look at the scatter graph there, actually the lowest demand expenditures is July and August. Folks don't get, just because they sign a contract, doesn't mean they get all the money up front. And those are spread out for many school employees over 10 months and then the rest over 12. And that's where you'll see the biggest expenditures are actually in June with 17%, in May with 11%, about 28% of the expenditures are at the end of the year. And so there's a pretty large cushion of money, if you see the red line on the scatter graph, that's going to be flowing above expenditures. It'll get in excess of $180 million. So that was one question. I wanted to make sure everybody was clear on that. I think, the first rule on this deal, somebody's going to make interest on our school dollars tonight. Somebody's going to make interest. Now, there's a real cost. It's not like borrowing from your family and doing that. It doesn't matter what account. It's a cost. We have to pay that cost to borrow money. So we borrow that money so folks in the blue line, that's all of us, and these folks in this enormous green line, we borrow that money so they can enjoy that. And that comes at a cost. We upfront the money by borrowing when we wouldn't have to. And we do that so folks can make $40,000 in this district, $20,000 in this district, but in these nine districts they can make $1 million or $500,000 or whatever. And that gives kids in that district a real different educational experience. It's not about local wealth. It's about the state's wealth. The coal and the gas in certain counties of our state are all our wealth, just like our wildlife. It's all the people's wealth. And folks, just because of accidental birth in a certain school district, shouldn't enjoy some advantage. That's really the issue here. So the constitutionality is important. The cash flow is huge. We've got a cash flow issue that we have to borrow over $360 million for. That is a cost. It's not borrowing from the right hand and putting it in the left pocket or any of that. It doesn't matter what account we borrow from, it is a cost. And the other cost we haven't heard much about is the opportunity cost. And we did some quick math in the treasurer. This handout that you got about the interfund borrowing, we had a testimony from the treasurer's office. And again, they had to sell fixed income securities to cash flow the school foundation program. And so when you do the math on that, you go from 12% liquid securities, where we could be in 3%. The opportunity cost on that is another $7 million a year. I mean, it's a significant amount of money. So this thing just starts rolling. There's a cost in more than just the interest we pay. There's an opportunity cost. There's a cash flow issue that is real, where districts like Sweetwater have to use their own resources, block grant resources, to borrow money. That shouldn't have to happen. And then the other part is the constitutionality. Hey, my kids were born in an entitlement district. They shouldn't have any different experience than the guys born in the recapture district. That's the bottom line. This isn't about the banks. There's plenty of other methods to get liquidity in our banks. We talked about the time deposit open account program that's not even about half used right now. This bill actually allows the treasurer to add more money to that. So it's not about that. And I don't know where that's all come from. This is about cash flow. It's about constitutionality. And it's about the cost of the way we're doing business. And I submit to you, it's not only the $12 million in interest that we pay and lose, but it's the interest we pay, but the interest we lose. And that 9% of that entire permanent land fund that has been here since statehood, 9% of it has to be in cash, can't be in fixed securities. And that's a real cost to the future. So, folks, again, you want to save money on education costs. This is the lowest fruit we have right here. Then we can talk about busing, I think, and special ed and teacher salaries and class size and regional cost adjustment and all those other things that we need to talk about. But this is the easiest decision, and so I encourage your support of the bill. Thank you.
In an effort to catch our breath, Representative Throne.
My apologies to the body, but I have some privilege of the floor, please.
Please proceed.
You can take a little break, reorganize your charts, gather your thoughts. I have some good friends here that I'd like to introduce. You know, my friends don't show up from Cheyenne, so I have to import my friends from Campbell County. I'd like to introduce Carol Yonke and Joe Lenny, family who's not really family. Thank you.
Representative Pedersen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need to declare a conflict on Senate File 106.
So noted. Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, you'll be delighted to know that I'm not standing here to argue about this. I just and debate it. I have a series of questions that the experts can write down as I recite these questions. And the first question involves, it all started with a meeting that I attended after I was appointed to the Education Committee in December. It was an interim meeting. And this issue did come up. And at the time it said, you know, the issue was that these recapture districts were hanging on to this money and it was they were generating a lot of interest and it wasn't counted as part of their local resources and we had this imbalance and unfairness. which I've swallowed. I mean, I believed it, and I know that I come from a recapture county and school district, so I was prepared, you know, to really support this and say, you know, this ain't right. We can't be doing this because arguably the recapture component of our property taxes is really the state's money. It's to redistribute to other districts. It's not our money. And so I was expecting in the interim that after they had made a motion to instruct their staff to come up with a bill on this, that we'd have a page and a half bill that says, you know, if you're a recapture district, you got to send in the extra amount of money as soon as you get it, because you're not entitled to it. It's not your money. And I thought that would be the end of it. And that kind of is reflected, if I'm not mistaken, you can answer this, by that red kind of the mountaintop area of this graph on that handout there, the long, skinny handout. So that was one question. You know, how did, you know, kind of to someone that's not totally familiar with this, how did this turn into Topsy? I mean, it just, we have a small problem. It sounds to me like we all agree that 90% of the problem is the recapture money. And then as we move to question number two, you know, I have not heard yet today how or why local resources can't be redefined to include an interest return, to include interest returns. In other words, if there's some problem with, you know, deducting that from a block grant, I haven't heard the answer to that. And if it isn't a problem with it, why can't they send that in? Anybody that makes interest on their investment's got to send it in because it's because of our largesse is what caused you to get the interest. All right, so the next question is number three. How much, and I'm sure somebody can answer this, but how much of this borrowing to local districts occurs because of the bargain basement interest rate we charge? You know, I've heard people say, well, you know, it should be zero interest for the school districts to borrow money when they need it, and you know, we should be paying 6 or 7% to the permanent fund when we need to borrow it into the foundation account to pay for this. But, you know, this gets back to the reason I don't lend my kids any money. You know, as soon as you start lending your kids money, they don't want to pay any interest, which a parent normally relents to. And then when they don't have to pay any interest, they're real slow in paying it back. And I think we might have a little of this in school districts, especially when you look at that column on another page here, the second to the last page of this last one, where you got $448 million of reserves or whatever. I'm just wondering if the moral hazard we haven't built into this is that, you know, why take money out of your savings account if you can get it from the old man at 0% interest, where in this case we're the old man. You know, the other issue is the 45% is the number we've fallen upon as far as the money that went into or that is going into local banks, and the rest is being exported out. I just have a short question. That's number four. How much of that is because of this oddball situation? Well, I guess you call it a banking crisis and a financial crisis that our monetary system's in right now. And is it really true that the 45% number would have been true 5 years ago or 3 years ago, something like that? I guess the other question I had is if my original idea of just the recapture money being the big issue here that had to be settled and sent to the state immediately, how much of this cash flow problem, which I'm talking about borrowing $212 million and then $166 million later, what would those numbers have looked like if we had just dealt with the recapture money And would that have solved the problem? Number six, the question is, why is it we have to, well, it's kind of related to the other, why do we have to wait till June before we call in the recapture money when we're entitled to it as soon as it accrues? So that's my questions, and I'm on the fence, but I don't know how long I'm going to be on the fence here, depending upon your answers, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to remind the body that we do need to maintain a quorum on the floor. So if some of you are just outside, you might count around to make sure we do have a quorum. Representative Freeman.
Could we answer some questions first?
One second. If we could hold you up, they would like to answer some questions first. Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm an old lady. I can't remember all of these things, but I think the first response I want to give to the previous speaker on all of those questions is the current system, the current practice is inefficient. And that's really why this came about. It came about for two reasons. Efficiency, not at its peak, and inequality. And we really have looked at a lot of different scenarios. Now, do I have all the numbers on all of the questions that were asked before? No, but I think that we had tried to work through many of these to show you that if you look at the top of I guess we should have numbered these, but it's the first long legal sheet. But when you look at the actual, the reason we just can't give them a lump sum in July or whatever month you want to choose is because those monies don't come in. They are assessed valuations. They're collected property taxes. They come from the county treasurer. They come through that whole process, and then they're distributed to the school's local bank. So the reason, and there was testimony on the at the other side of the Capitol on when that timing should take place, so that's how we adjusted the date so that it would happen on the 10th of every month in order to provide more efficiency to our school districts. But the areas that we receive the most income are in the months of November and December and May and June. That's just how the taxes are collected. The revenue comes in. We can't change that part. The response I would have is that, do you really think it's fair for us to be spending our school foundation monies to give everyone up front, meaning our local banks and our school districts, interest-free money in large sums that we would not, as a state, want to be fiscally responsible in making certain, whether it's 7% or 4% or 8%, $353 million earning that interest, I think is a fiscally responsible and prudent thing for us to be doing. And I think that those monies do come back to our local communities. You know, I love my bankers too, just like the rest of you out there. And I love my community, and I want our communities to be viable. At the same time, I'm asked to make certain that we're financially sound in providing education to all students. That's dictated by the Supreme Court. That's why we have this issue. It's based on that diction. So no matter where the money comes from, whether it comes from your county level or your state level, it is our job to make certain that we provide an equal education to all of our children.
Representative Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be brief. Sweetwater County has been used a couple times for an example of why this law is necessary. We have two school districts I guess I've said Sweetwater County before, so I'll say it again. School district number one is the largest one, and the one by the Green River is smaller. The school district by Green River had to borrow approximately $2.7 million last year in order to take care of its cash flow. It only needed the money for 1 month. And what happened was they had to put out a six-month bond issue because that's the only way that they could issue it, or the only economical way of doing that. The point has been made that school districts don't need money in the summer. Well, if you're talking about salaries, and that is the largest part of any school district's budget, that's entirely true. But that's also when we start to buy the supplies, the books, and other points like that. So there is a sizable amount of money that goes out with the school district at that particular time. The next thing that I would like to talk about is how much money we do give the school districts each year. The way that I've read the bill and understand the bill is that you're going to get the same amount of money that you had the year before. Well, last year I put out so much money for my household, but when my student or when my son becomes a college student, all of a sudden I have tuition and I need more money. From what I read in the bill, it doesn't have that adjustment. What happens if we have a cost adjustment to the school districts? Is that also going to be made in that also? I don't think that that's been taken care of. Much has been said about recapture districts. I was a BOCES member in a recapture district, and I listened to that school board, and they had other needs to where that they had to take care of very quickly. And although I don't feel sorry for them, I recognize the needs that they have to do, and they have to have a little bit more money to go through there. I think we've been playing games with numbers. 2.7 out of the $14 million that was accredited to my county, with only $3 million, because I round off because I'm not good at math, I don't think that the other school district used 11. I think that we have a small problem that needs to be addressed, and it's my opinion that Senate File 106 is not the mechanism to fix those. I advise you to vote against the bill.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I came down to this session after having consultation, number of visits with my school district. And by the way, I come from an entitlement district. The instruction and the conversations I had from back home, Dave, we've got to, Representative Bonner, we've got to oppose this change in coming down the pike in House Bill 106. And on this basis, that with apologies to my good friend, the representative from District 53, it was not the bankers I was worried about, it was the school district, because my school district demonstrated to me that they have earned between $30,000 and $45,000 a year in interest earnings, largely in those bubble periods following the receipt of taxes collected on the 6 mil and 25 mil levy, and when they'd get a check from the treasurer, they'd make some money. I am starting to hear, and I think I'm going to be willing to place some trust in the graphs that have been presented to us, and in particular, the graph that shows now tells me that my district is still going to be able to earn some interest income because the distributions are going to outpace expenses. There is still, I think we're going to, as I read this graph, we're just going to spread out those bubbles that have benefited my district, and I'm ready to not fall on my sword for the couple times a year when they really cashed in, but I think there's still money to be made as a district, and so I find myself not going against my district, but going to be able to explain my district why I find I can support House Bill 106. Thank you.
In the 60th minute of debate, Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, and this is an important issue, and I appreciate everyone's support, and I think the last representative that spoke has got it. That is the issue. You are going to still receive interest income. It's not going to be in bubbles any longer. So I do appreciate his good comments. Sweetwater County 1 did receive borrowed $12.25 million in the last year. I wanted to clarify that. And then I also wanted to clarify that there's a memo that is currently circulating that says that school finance, this scheme is constitutional. The real issue with that, and if you track back through the references in that memo, you'll discover that it refers to 2113.310 that talks about all revenues received or collected by the district during the previous school year, not excluding any amount from private contributions or gifts, shall be considered a local resource. So it would appear as though that's the case, but if you dig a little bit farther, you will discover that, in fact, interest income is not considered a local resource. In 1999, we repealed 21.13.310 Romanet 11 that says interest, capital gains, and other interests in the fund or the district provided during the previous school year, excluding interest income, shall not be considered. And so what happened was in 1999, we made the policy decision that interest income will not count as a local resource. So the memo that's been distributed is factually incorrect, and I believe we do have a constitutional crisis.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you so much, and I'll be extremely brief because I think we're getting very tired of this bill and of this situation. I'm not 100% sure how Sweetwater got to be the poster child here, but I will tell you that both school districts in Sweetwater County are in staunch opposition to this for all the reasons I discussed earlier. And the real crux of this thing, without going through all of the charts and all of the graphs and everything, is this bill, I think somebody said it's kind of like Topsy, and it kind of is. It's a simple problem. It was a simple problem that had a simple fix that was proposed and rejected in terms of this. I will tell you, if for no other reason to oppose this bill hasn't been vetted. It was actually drafted relatively hastily as part of the school recalibration program in terms of trying to respond to local resources from the little two-page number. It hasn't been vetted. It hasn't been addressed by any of the groups that usually look at issues like this in relation to school districts. I think we're trying to solve a problem that isn't really there except for a couple of districts. I don't think we have looked at all of the solutions that are available. We've heard two or three different options just in the debate now. I think this is an issue that deserves a lot more time and a lot more study, and I would urge your opposition of this bill. Thank you.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would have to respectfully disagree with my former speaker there. This has been vetted. We spent a lot of time school finance recalibration with the school districts, with the state treasurer's office, down the hall, and quite frankly, I spent a lot of time on it last week. We had over 4 hours of presentation, testimony, and discussion, and numerous days of meetings and emails and phone calls. This is not a new issue. And, you know, really, I would agree with you. I would like a two-page bill. And we thought when we brought this subject up this summer in school finance recalibration that we could do that. But when we saw the inequalities and the inefficiencies in our current system, it required us to go into a much more extensive piece of legislation. And at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is be fair, and what we want to do is support our school system, our districts, and make certain that they are able to efficiently operate and provide our children with a good education and work within the model. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion? Is there any other discussion? Question being called for. All those in favor of Chairman Berger's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report to do so with a recommendation that Senate File 106 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Okay. All those in favor, please stand up. All those opposed, please stand. Having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Barbuto.
No.
Berger.
Aye.
Blake.
No.
Flickery. Flickery Conflict. Bonner.
Aye.
Botten.
Aye.
Frechtel. Brown.
Aye.
Burkhart.
Aye.
Bird. Bird. Campbell.
No.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Childers. Excused. Connolly.
No.
Kraft.
No.
Davison. Excused. Edmonds.
No.
Eklund.
Aye.
Esquivel.
Aye.
Freeman.
No.
Gay.
Aye.
Gingery.
Aye.
Goggles.
No.
Greer.
No.
Green.
Aye.
Harshman.
Aye.
Harvey.
No.
Hunt.
No.
Illaway.
No.
Yagi.
No.
Kasparik.
No.
Croker. Crone.
No.
Lockhart.
No.
Laux.
Aye.
Lubno.
No.
Madden.
No.
McKim.
No.
McComey.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Moniz.
Aye.
Nicholas.
Aye.
Patton.
No.
Peasley.
No.
Pedersen. Pedersen Conflict. Peterson.
No.
Petrov.
No.
Korberg.
No.
Roscoe.
No.
Simlick. Shepperson.
Aye.
Stewart.
No.
Stubson.
Aye.
Teeters.
Aye.
Throne.
No.
Vronish.
No.
Wallace.
No.
Swanitzer Dan.
No.
Swanitzer Dave.
No.
Mr. Speaker.
Aye.
Bird.
Excuse.
Bird excused. I'm about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Esquivel? No, aye to no. Esquivel, aye to no. Miller, aye to no. Are there any other changes? The vote is closed. 20 ayes, 35 noes, 3 excused, 2 conflicts.
Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, Senate File 106, having failed, a roll call vote is indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File number 71. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 71, introduced by Senator Christensen, an act relating to education regarding hunter safety courses. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Burkhart, Freeman, Croker, Crone, Laux, Dieters, No, Connolly, Madden. Signed, Representative Brechtel, Vice Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill Senate File 71 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I will turn the bill over to the good sponsor.
Representative Yeagie.
Wow, we get a break. New thing that we get to talk about. Notice I have my basketball tie on. The Cowpokes are playing tonight, so we... This one is a hunter safety education class. It was brought from the other side, been through there. Hunter education started in 1977, and I was one of the first hunter education instructors, so I've got a way low number, been teaching this ever since it started. In fact, I have a class as soon as I get home that is going to be going. And it says that anybody that's born after January 1st of 66 needs to take this hunter safety class before you can hunt or fish in Wyoming. The trouble, well, and also if you hunt on the Grand Teton National Park, areas 75 and 79. And so in the classes I teach, I have a bunch of adults, not a bunch, but some adults who just want to get those special tags for the Teton Refuge, come and take this. The trouble is when we get home, I always try to teach two classes a year, and I will have about 30 kids in the class, and that's a lot of kids, and you have to get special permission to have that many. I have kids from Rock Springs, from Green River, from Kemmer, from Evanston come because there just are not enough hunter education instructors. And it creates quite a bottleneck of kids wanting to get hunter safety. They can start hunting as young as 12, and that's when they can get a big game license.
And so to alleviate this, I think the good sponsor from the other side saw the need for this and brought this up. I have talked to some superintendents, talked to mine a couple times today, and had one from one of the real big schools. And they said this really wouldn't be a problem to them because of the extracurricular class that could be taught, and they would treat it as an elective class. Now, when I was teaching, I actually taught hunter safety right in the class. I got permission from the principal to teach it, and it fit very well. Taught it for 9 weeks, and there's a lot of material you can get. The number of hours required for a hunter safety class is 12. And so if you can't, if you just couldn't find time in the class day, then they could have it as an extracurricular. Now, it says that there's fifth and sixth graders would be able to take this in the schools, and there's about 6,700 fifth grade and 6,750 or fifth and sixth grade in each grade. And so these kids are 11 and 12 years old. So they're the ones that are going to be able to go hunting with their dads and their close friends. And so this was brought so we could try to get more kids involved with the knowledge of hunting, fishing, but also gun safety. And the Game and Fish and the Superintendent of Public Instruction are both very cooperative, willing to work with each other in getting this done. And if you look through the bill, on the first page, 21.9.101 is the education section of our statutes. And so this, the first section just says this is, it will be taught in the fifth and sixth grade, and the Game and Fish has everything set up to do this. Now, 23.2.106 on the bottom of page 2 is talking about the hunter, the Game and Fish statutes, and it's specifically about the hunter safety exception to this. So, well, there's a lot more I could say, but I think I'll just leave it at that and stand for any questions you might have. So that's the explanation of the bill.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Representative Kingery or Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. Maybe it could be a second reading amendment because it's a good bill. My only question was on line 8, it says the Professional Teaching Standards Board shall have no authority over who may be an instructor in the schools for these courses, so they're not going to have to go get to be certified teachers, which totally makes sense. And I went and looked in the statutes, and this isn't a new thing. We do it for driver's ed teachers. Driver's ed teachers don't have to be certified, so they're allowed to teach without going through the Professional Teaching Standards Board. But what I was curious about, there is another statute called Employee Security Requirements that says all employees of a school district who may have access to minors must submit to fingerprinting for the purpose of obtaining state or national criminal history record information before employment. So if they were employed, they would have to comply. But what I was guessing, because it says their instructors for the courses shall be approved by the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, so these are potentially the instructors could be people that are not employees of the school district, so then that wouldn't apply. So what I was wondering, maybe to stick in there on second reading, somewhere like on line 11, all instructors shall be compliant with 21-7401, which is the statute that requires criminal history background checks. I was just curious if the sponsor had thought that through or if that had been discussed any on the other side. That was my question.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hunting and safety, particularly handling of guns and all, have been a part of most of our lives, and so there's really no opposition to the purpose of the measure. However, when we look at line 15 and 16 on page 1, we don't make this as a prerogative or an extracurricular activity. We say in the bill that the school district shall provide instruction. I would just suggest perhaps, particularly in light of the fact that the instructor does not have to be qualified under any standards board found on page 2, that perhaps it would be a little more palatable if we struck the shall and made it a may. I'll leave that to the sponsor.
Representative Yeagie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first one is, the first question, I'll get back to that second one. The first one is, if you teach in school, you do have to be checked. And what we'd really like to do is, I think the Game and Fish would like to certify teachers who are teaching in the school. If that didn't happen, then it would be after school, and the Game and Fish would help get those instructors available to teach that as an extracurricular. So the Game and Fish just doesn't have the personnel to teach the class, but they're really trying to get instructors certified, and that would be great. And by the way, to become certified as an instructor, you do give professional standard teaching board credit and continuing ed credit. So they're trying to work with the schools and getting this done. And I think in compliance with the first question, if we needed that in there, I don't think that would be a problem because they're not trying to do something that should not be done. And so that would be a good consideration. I'll talk to them and get with you on that. The second one is the shall versus the may. And the bringer of the bill, in consultation with the Game and Fish, really wanted that to be a shall, and they wanted to just about require this to be done. And so they did talk about a may or a shall, and the Game and Fish kind of went out on a limb and said, we will really try to help make this palatable to the school so it's not going to be an onerous thing that we're thrusting on them. I did talk to one superintendent, and he said that, you know, their curriculum's pretty full, and to have this dictated to them, he would have to work within the district. But if it says a little later it could be taught as an extracurricular class after school, and he thought he could work with that. So I think they were pretty insistent that they wanted to say shall. I think those were those two.
Representative Connolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to just bring the body's attention to the discussion that we were just having, because I think it's really important as we spend a session really thinking about education. Know that what this bill does is it directs, if you look on page 1, line 15, not later than the 2011-12 school year, so next year, all school districts shall provide instruction in safety and competency in handling firearms as provided in the rest of this act. This bill tells each and every one of our districts that fifth or sixth grade is obligated to provide instruction in one way or another in the handling of firearms for hunting. We had some testimony from one superintendent who happened to be there asking about what this would mean, and what he responded is, it most likely would need to take the place of a gym class or be included as part of a gym class. That was a concern. It means that kids weren't getting outside and exercising, for example. But again, on and against this bill, because it is a mandate to each and every one of our districts that they shall provide this kind of instruction. Thank you.
Representative Ronish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have mixed feelings on this. And first, let me tell you, I am a hunter safety instructor. And I've taught it since 1983, not nearly as old as that gray-haired guy up front. And
oh.
I had, while I was really active teaching, I've dropped out now because I didn't have the time for it. I got too many conflicts and I couldn't get enough help during the class, so I kind of dropped out doing it actively. But when I was teaching it, I had a junior high school teacher that I certified that decided he wanted to teach it in school. And I thought it was a great program because I give only 12 hours of instruction when they're in the school, they got 40 hours of instruction. And so I would encourage it to happen in a school whenever possible. The conundrum, the way I feel about it is we're having problems with education. And now we say they shall do it. And some of these small school districts are going to have a hard time doing it. And some of the larger school districts are going to have a difficult time. And I think we should encourage them to do it. I think we should enable them to do it. But I just can't say that they shall do it. I'm sorry. So if we had an amendment to take that shall to May, I could vote for it on third reading. Thank you.
Representative Croker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the bill, I think it's a great idea. And I kind of want to clear up what I think is some misconception out there for the shall offer it. The shall is that they shall make it available. We had testimony that they can make it available in the evening, on weekends. It doesn't have to be part of the regular school curriculum, and they don't have to require students to take it. They just have to make it available for the students to take. And it was my understanding from his testimony, the same superintendent that said that they would not be able to offer it during school hours in gym said that they would be able to make it work by having someone from Game and Fish come in and teach it on weekends or in the evenings. So that option is there. And I just think it's so important. In our culture of Wyoming, we have guns. There are guns around. To just be able to teach kids at a young age safety and responsibility and proper ways to interact with handguns is a lot better than letting them learn it from watching it on TV or, you know, God forbid, stumbling across a gun somewhere and not know how to handle it. So I think it's something valuable that we should make available to our kids. And again, the shall make it available. That doesn't mean the kids have to take it, and that doesn't mean that it has to be during school hours.
Representative Yeagie.
Thank you. Appreciate the discussion, and I will check on both of the things that were brought up and get back to the folks that had those concerns. So I'd appreciate you passing this along. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Teeter's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 71 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The chair is in doubt. All those in favor, please rise. All those in favor, please stand. For all those opposed, please stand. Senate File 71 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is Senate File 14. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 14, introduced by the Corporation Committee, an act relating to county election districts. This bill was sent to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Illaway, Yeagie, Croker, Patton, Shepperson, Stubson. No, Blickery, Byrd, Roscoe. Sign representing Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 14 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Standing Committee Amendment changed a few words, and instead of just leaving it member, we changed it to multi-member in four different places. And we also allowed
allowed districts that in the election districts, if they wanted to go to less than five or more than five election districts, they could do so. So we struck five on page 2, line 4. So I'd ask for an affirmative vote on the Standing Committee Amendment.
You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those in favor, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, the representative from House District 56 will explain the bill.
Representative Stupson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 14 really came about because we looked at the districting statutes that currently exist and realized that many of the mechanisms that we needed really both for districting and redistricting just weren't there. And so this bill is an effort to more accurately spell out what the process is for districting and redistricting. It clarifies that the county authorities have the authority to redistrict if they need to. You'll see a lot of it is just sort of mechanics. On page 4, you'll see it talks about the mechanics of if you have a five, you know, you go to three, from 3 to 5, you create a districting scheme, how they you rotate those districts and that sort of thing. The biggest issue that you may have heard about with respect to this bill is what those districts might look like. And we had a lot of discussion both in the interim and as session has gone along with what we should do with this bill. Should we mandate that they be single-member districts, or how should we treat those? And really, the interim committee and we as a standing committee during the session have taken the approach that we want to give counties the most flexibility that we possibly can. And so because the process is for this, is ultimately it has to be done by petition of the voters in a county. It has to a plan has to be approved by the county members. And so we thought, you know, the counties could decide for themselves what sort of plan fit best. And we heard from a number of counties throughout the state that they would like that flexibility. And so as you saw in the Standing Committee amendment and as you see in the bills that currently stands, it really allows districts to do single-member districts. It allows them to do a combination of single-member districts and at-large districts or even multi-member districts. And it gives the counties that authority to decide what is best for them and what their voters want. And there was a lot of discussion about the lawsuit over in Fremont County and the districting that occurred over there. There has been some misconception that this bill is directly tied to that, and while that issue certainly brought these questions to the forefront, this has no relationship to the districting plan in that county because it's governed by a court order, and they will be subject to that court order until and unless they are found to be in compliance with the Voters' Rights Act. So this really doesn't impact them in any immediate sense. What it is for the rest of the counties that may decide to do to go to a district system. So with that, I'd take any questions that the members may have.
Mr. Minority Floor Leader Goggles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of comments before I ask my questions. First of all, I was a witness subpoenaed by a group of lawyers regarding the Fremont County case, and I gave testimony at a deposition for about 5 hours. The court ruling actually used some of my deposition as the basis for their ruling, and I will tell you that the reason for that case is longstanding, and I won't go back and rehash that. That's not germane to this discussion. My concern is that this bill doesn't set us back in that county, and we have to do this all over again, that we have to go back to court, that we have to have this long, protracted legal process that doesn't solve anything. It only creates more. And I'll say it bluntly, creates more racial tension. My role in all this was to bring understanding, and my role here is to ensure that we continue that understanding and that we don't set ourselves back 10 years and we're back to the same old, we're back to the same point we started 10 years ago. So my questions are, in terms of the flexibilities to counties, does this concurrent amendment in law provide for counties such as the one I'm residing in the ability to go back and run a referendum of voters to change back to a district or an at-large voting for those particular elected officials? And also in terms of the partition of voters, because now we're talking about districts, five districts, and we would talk about a referendum vote in each one of those districts, and we would obviously, in my case, you'd have four districts that would probably outvote one district. And what the voters want, that one district wants representation, that I know for sure, because I represented that in those legal proceedings. So if you can answer those questions for me, I'd appreciate it.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I mean, Mr. Chairman. Sorry about that. I promoted you. You're probably not one.
Either way.
But I'm here to ask some questions because I wasn't in the committee meeting. But the only place that I'm aware of multi-member districts and political elections are held are in nonpartisan districts, nonpartisan elections, otherwise community colleges, school boards, those types of elections, not where you have party elections, where it's political parties we're talking about. And this was brought about by a court ruling that said we have to be in compliance with the Federal Voter Act. And I'm concerned that this was, we're putting something in statute that will, as the good gentleman just said, take us back to court, because when you're doing partisan politics, you're involved in what we've done nationally. And I've got kind of concern about that. Maybe somebody can answer those questions for me.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for my good friend from Fremont County. Looking at page 5 of the bill, we see that this bill becomes effective immediately. If we could address some of your concerns about issues ongoing currently, and if we could delay the effective date of this bill, would that address your concerns?
Mr. Minority Floor Leader Goggles.
In answer to my good friend there, I would say yes, that would address some of my concerns. But, folks, I don't speak for every individual in that area. I speak for the people that I represent in House District 33. And that's where most of the questions are coming from. I don't speak for the entire county. But I would say yes to your question.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer the good gentleman from the center of the state, the court case is the court case, and no matter what occurs, the decision of the court case made it very plain and clear. This bill would not force you to go back. This bill gives counties the opportunity to be as flexible as they want to be and how they want to do things in their county. Your county has already made its decision. And so that decision is that decision. And this bill certainly does not go back and rehash that court case. What this has done is going forward and allows, now, Laramie County just voted to go to five commissioners. They decided not to go districts, but I'm not sure what they're going to do, whether they're going to elect them all at large or they're going to divide some. I don't know. But this certainly gives counties that opportunity to divide it any way they want to divide it. But I did want to answer your question was, no, your court case has been settled, and we're moving ahead.
Thank you for those answers.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? Representative Stupson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to give one other example how this might work and why the flexibility is important. We had one county from the western part of the state that came in and testified at committee that really wanted this flexibility because they have four different areas of population in their county, and they were looking at the potential of doing four different districts and then having one commissioner serve at large, and that was something that they saw would work well with their county, make sure that the different areas of the county had representation on the commission level. And that's really what we're focused at, recognizing that we have 23 very different counties across the state with different geographic and population distributions. We wanted to make sure that there were the tools that counties could design a system that worked best for them.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to add the one thing, this bill wasn't constructed for a county. As the committee discussed it, they did try and make it so that it was optional, and they did have different kinds of options. The one thing that we discovered, which from Natrona County just explained, if a county wanted to have a multi-member district, say two people in one district in one part of the county and then two in another, the way the original bill was drawn, the county people then would find themselves in the position of having to vote against the entire population of the county, which would be disruptive to the numerical allocation. Thus, we put in so that it could be that a district could be a single-member district as well as multi-member districts within the same county and thereby meet the federal standards.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 14 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 14 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 48. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 48, introduced by the Wildlife and Natural Resource Travel Committee, an act relating to the Wyoming Wildlife and Natural Resource Trust Account Board. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Botten, Connolly, Davison, Yagi, McKim, McComey, Petroff, Shepherdson, signed representing McComey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman McComey?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, let it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 48 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments. Ladies and gentlemen, this bill was brought to us by the Wildlife and Natural Resource Trust Account Board. And what this is, ladies and gentlemen, is this board, the way it's structured now with the kind of staggered terms it has now, they can have a turnover on the board of all of the board or 50% of the board. And the terms were for 3 years. Testimony before the committee was this is a very busy and active committee, and they go out personally and see every one of these sites that they're recommending that you'll see in a bill. It'll come up hopefully tomorrow or some other time before we close. So it takes 2 to 3 years just to really learn the board. So they'd like to go to six-year terms for the members. And this does that, and it also creates a way to stagger the board members so you'd turn the board over a third at a time. And with that, I'd stand for questions.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 48 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 48 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Okay, the next bill for our consideration is Senate file number 88. Reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate file 88, introduced by Senator Burns, an act relating to expungement of nonviolent felonies. This bill was referred to committee number one, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Nicholas, Throne. No, Barbudo, Brechtel, Crone, Peasley. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 88 do pass. And I also move standing committee amendment number one to Senate File 88, and I would turn the explanation of the bill and the standing committee amendment over to the to Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 88 is expungement of nonviolent felonies. What the testimony was in committee was that there are certain felonies that the punishment for a mistake in youth follows people unintendedly all the way through life to the point where even folks can't get life insurance and certain benefits and jobs. And so there are certain nonviolent felonies that if you make a youthful mistake after 10 years, and you are no danger to society, you can forgive. What the Committee of the Whole Amendment does in the first part of the amendment is it says that 10 years have to pass after the expiration of terms of sentence imposed by the court, including periods of probation, and the completion of any program ordered by the court, and restitution in full. So after restitution is all of those things are done, then the 10-year period starts to occur. Expungement can only occur if it's one felony or a series of felonies that happened in one occurrence. The felony was not used in a firearm. There's a filing fee of $300. The county attorney sends notice to any victim, and then it's granted in the court's discretion. The prosecuting attorney will review the file, and the amendment changes the days to a 60-day time limit to object. There's a limit on the time that has to be respond. The court may deem that the relief is eligible if there's no harm to society and then put the records under seal, but sending a copy of to the Division of Criminal Investigation so that they always have a record that felony occurred. The prosecutors are given immunity for their actions. In pursuing this bill, you can only have one expungement in a lifetime, and a restoration of rights taken away by felony except for sex offenders. Key witnesses are notified, and it is very restrictive to certain felonies. And after we dispense with the committee of the whole or the standing committee amendment, there's a committee of the whole amendment that I would like to move, which lists all of the felonies that you are ineligible for expungement for. With that, Mr. Chairman, unless there are questions, I'd call the question on the standing committee amendment.
Question having been called, all those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed say no. Standing committee amendment number one has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move committee of the whole amendment number one to Senate File 88 and ask for your favorable consideration. What this does is pretty much gut the bill and change it completely. What the bill listed was nonviolent felonies. This now includes an entire list of felonies for which you are not eligible for expungement, including murder, manslaughter, kidnapping, first or second degree sexual assault, robbery, aggravated assault, aircraft hijacking, arson, aggravated burglary, sexual abuse of a minor, homicide by vehicle, drug-induced homicide, all felony sex offenders, battery against a household member, child abuse, aggravated assault on battery on correction officers or detention officers, possession, manufacture, transportation, or sale of explosives, promoting prostitution, sexual exploitation of a minor, bribery, interference with a police officer, disarming a peace officer, escape by
by violence, perjury, use of a firearm while committing a felony, possession of an unlawful firearm, possession of a firearm by a felony, all of the sex registration offenses, felony DUI, felony drug possession. And so that's what the amendment does. If there are no questions on that, I'd call for a question on the amendment.
All those in favor of the committee of the whole amendment number one, please say aye. All those opposed, no. The committee of the amendment, committee of the whole amendment is adopted. We are back on the bill, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Is there any discussion? Mr. Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the committee of the whole amendment. That fixed a lot of the issues that I had to add in a bunch more. I'm still concerned. Some of the ones that we've left out still are incest, abandoning a child. Most of the white-collar crimes are still out. Some of my concerns is this. If you open the bill, it says you have to wait 10 years from the time after your sentence has elapsed. So here's what could happen. You're sentenced to a 10, let's just use 10 years. Let's say you've been sentenced on a crime, you stole a lot of money or something. You're sentenced to 10 years. When you get out, you still have to be on parole. So that, let's add another maybe 3 years for parole. So now it's 13. Now, on top of that, now you got to wait the 10, and now you're going to finally file. So, in essence, maybe 23 years has passed. Now the prosecuting attorney is expected to file an objection if he so chooses. No one in the office is going to have a clue about this case, and in many of these cases, we're not even going to be able to find the file. So we're not going to have much knowledge of what this case was even about and whether or not this person we should object or not object to the expungement. It could have been a big case 23 years ago that people are really concerned about in the community. That's just one concern. I think we can get beyond that, but I just had that concern. With that, my bigger concern is with licensing boards, and actually the more serious crimes, like murder and stuff, I might actually be more apt to do those because those are usually heat of passion type crimes and they're never going to recommit. It's the white collar crimes that actually people recommit because once you steal, a lot of times you like to keep stealing because it's easy. And especially with white collar criminals, and they figure out how to do it, and they figure out how to get the money, and then they get out, and then they do it again. I'm concerned that if you're not including some of these white-collar crimes, that that licensing boards would not know, not to license that person. So that's a concern. But I like the idea. I guess I'm not completely opposed to the bill. I like the idea of people that have committed felonies that perhaps they can get their record expunged someday. But at the same time, this gets hard because you got to remember there's victims. And a lot of people will say, especially with white-collar crime, well, there's really no victim there. Well, when you lose your money or something, there was a victim there. And I appreciate the committee of the whole amendment. I'm still concerned, but I think it can keep moving on and maybe there can be some more second reading amendments to bring some more crimes in. But at some point, we may be bringing, I don't know what the bill does if we keep, like this, with this committee, the whole amendment, we've added now, we're down through T, so almost the whole alphabet. At some point, I'm not sure what's left to actually expunge.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The court file's always available, and you can always dig out the court file and find out about the case. This is just a function of policy. It depends how long do you want to continue punishing somebody for writing a felony bad check when they were 22 or 23 years old. I have no objection to adding other crimes if this body deems they're appropriate, but at some point, we have to bring people back into society. And if they made a mistake in their youth, after 10 years, and if you look on page 5 of the bill, paragraph G, the petitioner has to prove that he does not represent a substantial danger to himself, any identifiable victims of society. And if the petitioner doesn't prove that, they don't get the expungement. So that burden's on the petitioner to prove that, not on the state of Wyoming to disprove that. So we put a pretty heavy burden on those petitioners. Now, if you want to work with that language to make it even more arduous, I don't have any objection to that. But there has to be a time at which, for minor felonies that occur in people's youth, we let them go back to society and be able to buy life insurance and be able to participate in certain jobs and certain programs.
Is there any other discussion? Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one issue for discussion. You know, on the Committee of the Whole amendment, we added as a felony that you could not get an expungement for. It was, I think, on page one there on line 30, any offense punishable under 62301 through 320, and those are all the sex offenses. Now, that may render this issue moot, but on page six, beginning on the end of line six and continuing with line nine, the language there, an expungement granted under this section shall not restore rights. That may be somewhat inconsistent with the amendment we just passed, because this contemplates that you can get an expungement. It's just that your rights will not be restored if you were convicted of a sexual assault pursuant to 62301 through 320. So we may have to fix that. But let's assume for a moment, since this language is still in the bill, I guess, and by the way, I like the bill because I like the idea that for certain felonies, after so much time has gone by and someone's led an exemplary life, you know, and I think of felony check charges as the first thing that comes to mind. I don't think that, you know, that should probably preclude them from voting ultimately or getting a good job, you know, for a mistake in their youth. But if we made the policy decision to allow an expungement for sexual assault, which I don't think we should, is it inconsistent then to say, well, but they're not going to get their rights restored as well? And then my other question is would they still have to register if they get an expungement? I guess I don't understand what it exactly means. Does it mean they can't apply under the restoration statutes that we have in place? And so I'm on and for the bill. It needs a little work, but I'd like to know, you know, what the policy decision is going to be with regard to sexual assault. I don't think they should get an expungement at all. But to say that we're going to expunge it, but then they don't get their rights restored, it just is inconsistent to me. So,
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Subsection M says an expungement of records pursuant to this section shall restore any rights removed as a result of the conviction for which the expungement has been granted. So you get rights for any, you get your rights back for any expungement. The language on lines 6, 7, 8, and 9 is surplusage as a result of the amendment we made, because you can't get an expungement for any sex crimes. And I hope that answers the good speaker's questions.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem.
Just to clarify for both the Speaker and the Majority Floor Leader, since it was your amendment, you guys actually took that part out, the part that you guys are talking about. Lines 7, 8, and 9 are all out of the bill. So this whole part about restoring their rights for sexual assault, you actually deleted that. So I don't think you have an issue with that anymore. And actually, in your amendment, you actually put that no one who's is a registrable offense, they can't get expunged. So none of the sexual assault stuff actually plays into this bill now because of that amendment. And I appreciate that. I would point out, just for the speaker, incest is actually not in the sexual assault statutes. I don't know why it's not, but it's over in a different section. I just knew that. And so I just point out that incest, it did not get included. I know that was your intent, probably by including all the sexual assault, but you might want to bring incest back in. My point is, and as to obtaining records, the problem is they give the prosecutor 30 days. Well, I'll tell you where all the court records are. They're down and sitting in archives down here in Cheyenne. And I've tried to obtain them before sometimes, and, you know, it's not nobody's fault down here, but, it takes longer than 30 days to get a court file from 20, 30 years ago, because we certainly don't keep them back at the courthouse. In the prosecutor's office, you know, we actually destroy our files after they're about 10 years old. So I think there's going to be a lot of trouble trying to figure out what in the world this case was even about. And lastly, we do have this in the law already. It's called a pardon. You know, you can always, if you know someone who has a felony that you think they should not have that felony on their record, you can go to the governor. And they have a wonderful process. They review it. You have to submit some documents. The governor reviews it. He makes a determination whether or not to grant the pardon or not grant the pardon. And he actually has some powers below just the pardon. He can do some other things too. But I think we already have a good process. It's through the governor. The process slows down a little bit. This thing moves way too fast. The prosecutor's got 30 days to figure it out, you know, submit his objection and get into court, and we have no clue. You know, I know everyone keeps downplaying bad checks. I got to tell you, if you've been charged with a felony for bad checks, not a misdemeanor, you were writing a lot of bad checks. That's a bad thing. You know, if we don't think bad checks are a bad thing, let's take it off the books then. But, you know, when I've had to deal with people that have done this, you know, you have a lot of victims coming in that are pretty upset. And I didn't understand the life insurance thing. I didn't understand, was that testimony or something that, just a legitimate question, I just didn't understand that. Can you not get life insurance if you have a felony?
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what we heard in committee from an individual who hoped that this bill would provide some relief for him, that he was unable to buy insurance because of the felony on his record. Now, Mr. Chairman, I say we don't need to bend over backwards for these people. Certainly they have not been the best actors in our society, and they haven't been our best and our brightest, and probably haven't forwarded a lot of social good that we'd like to see. And yet, at some point, they pay their debt to society. And at some point, we ought to recognize that's the case. And the arguments that I heard just amount to the fact that it's too much administrative trouble. Well, we're going to have trouble finding the record. We're busy doing other stuff. We got to get busy and do something in a hurry, all those sorts of things. And I just don't think if you don't like the time period, that's one thing. Maybe the time period ought to be longer. But if we're truly going to recognize the fact that someone can pay their debt to society and eventually and give them the hope that someday they can reinstate themselves in the eyes of the law and in the eyes of society, then I don't think some concerns about administrative delay ought to stand in the way. Whenever that time comes, on and for the bill.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 88 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 88 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Let me remind you, you only have 45 minutes to get third reading amendments in for the budget. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
Oh, you have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The motion carries.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. Senate File 150, recommended do pass. Senate File 59, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 108, recommended do pass. Senate File 39, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 7, recommended do pass. Senate File 57, recommended do pass. Senate File 89, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 16, recommended do pass. Senate File 36, recommended do pass. Representative Lubnow moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again, and the motion prevailed. Senate File 101, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 106, Representative Pedersen announced a conflict of interest on Senate File 106. Representative Blickery announced a conflict of interest on Senate File 106. Following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. Senate File 71, recommended do pass. Senate File 14, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 48, recommended do pass. Senate File 88, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Signed, Representatives Wanzer Dave. Chairman.
I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. Committee of the Whole report is adopted. Messages from the Senate.
Message 282, Mr. Speaker. Senate File 128, abandoned vehicle storage expenses. The Senate failed to concur on the House amendments to the bills as below by the vote indicated. Ayes 0, noes 30. The Senate requests the House appoint a conference committee number 1 to meet with a like committee from the Senate to report recommended amendments to the bill for final consideration by both houses. Signed, Donna Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 283, Mr. Speaker. The President appointed Senate conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from House on amendments to Senate File 128. Senator Hines, Chairman. Senator Case, Senator Christensen. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 284, Mr. Speaker. The Senate did concur on House amendments to the bills as below by the vote indicated. Senate File 94, liability for emergency equipment donations. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Donna Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 285, conferees appointed. Mr. Speaker, the President appointed Senate conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the House on amendments to House Bill 124. The Senate conferees are Senator Schiffer, Chairman, Senator Case, Senator Landon. Signed, Donna Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Appointment of joint conference committees, House Bill 124, Representative Korberg, Chairman, McKim, and Botten. Senate File 128, Representative Peasley, Chair, Representatives Vronish and Green. We're at that order of business reading and signing of enrolled acts. We'll first consider House Enrolled Act number 23. The reading clerk will read the enrolled act.
House Enrolled Act number 23, being original House Bill 9, an act relating to insurance being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act number 23, being original House Bill number 9. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act 24.
House Enrolled Act number 24, being original House Bill 62, an act relating to the Wyoming Controlled Substances Act, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
About to sign Enrolled Act number 24, being original House Bill 62. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act 25.
House Enrolled Act number 25, being original House Bill 95, an act relating to the hospitalization of mentally ill persons, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act number 25, being original House Bill 95. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act 26.
House Enrolled Act 26, being original House Bill 105, an act relating to child custody and visitation, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
About to sign Enrolled Act number 26, being original House Bill 105. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Joint Resolution Number 2.
Senate Enrolled Joint Resolution Number 2, being original Senate Joint Resolution Number 2, a joint resolution proposing to amend the Wyoming Constitution, creating a new section regarding health care decisions.
I'm about to sign.
Being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
That's right. I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Joint Resolution Number 2, being original Senate Joint Resolution Number 2. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 25.
Senate Enrolled Act 25, being original Senate File Number 24, an act relating to state investments, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
About to sign Enrolled Act Number 25, being original Senate File 24. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 26.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 26, being original Senate File 68, an act relating to probate, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
About to sign Enrolled Act Number 26, being original Senate File Number 68. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 27.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 27, being original Senate File 77, an act relating to county officers, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
About to sign Enrolled Act Number 27, being original Senate File 77. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 28.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 28, being original Senate File 63, an act relating to game and fish, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act Number 28, being original Senate File Number 63. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 29.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 29, being original Senate File Number 92, an act relating to natural gas storage, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
About to sign Enrolled Act Number 29, being original Senate File 92. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 30.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 30, being original Senate File 99, an act relating to sales and use tax, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
That's signed. Enrolled Act Number 30, being original Senate File 99. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 31.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 31, being original Senate File 117, an act relating to the University of Wyoming, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
About to sign Enrolled Act Number 31, being original Senate File 117. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 32.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 32, being original Senate File 135, an act relating to public funds, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
About to sign Enrolled Act Number 32, being original Senate File 135. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 33.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 33, being original Senate File 137, an act relating to the operation of motor vehicles, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
About to sign Enrolled Act Number 33, being original Senate File 137. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 34.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 34, being original Senate File 116, an act relating to oil and gas, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
About to sign Enrolled Act Number 34, being original Senate File 116. I have so signed. Are we ready for our cowgirl, Joe?
Mr. Speaker, committee announcements.
Yeah, we'll get to that. We have a schedule here. We're good.
Well. Well, two announcements. The Conference Committee on House Bill 23, our Senate File 23, will not meet tonight. We'll try tomorrow night. And your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will not meet tomorrow.
All right, we're going to switch it around. Just keep doing committee announcements. Chairman Lockhart, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your turnaround switching committee chair would like to announce that the Joint Conference Committee on House Bill 109 and House Bill 113 will meet in the Senate Minerals Chair. And if I may, on two other announcements. In your in-basket, you saw the legislative prayer breakfast. I'd encourage you to come, if you can, 6:30 at Egg and I. And last but not least, a good number of you have turned in your forms on the Race for the Cure. If you're out of forms, just let me know and I'll get you a new one. And thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet tomorrow, Thursday, February 17th, 10 minutes after adjournment, and we will hear one bill, Senate File 124, engrossed, overweight and oversized vehicle penalties.
Vice Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, Labor, will meet upon adjournment 15 minutes, about 20 minutes from now, to consider the following bills. Senate File 93, Dietetics Licensure, Senate File 37, Health Insurance Definition, Senate File 29, Developmental Disability Services, and Senate File 145, Medicaid Fraud Recovery. Room H-17.
Chairman Sinlek.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Two announcements. First, the Joint Conference Committee meeting on House Bill 18 has been rescheduled for Thursday, February 17th at 9 a.m. in room S-15. And secondly, the Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources will meet committee number 5 Thursday, February 17th at 8 a.m. in room H-11 to consider Senate Joint Resolution 7, bark beetle mitigation. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet immediately upon adjournment in 302 for considerations of Senate File 146, Teacher Accountability, Senate File 70, Educational Accountability. Senate files. Did I say House bills?
I don't know. I didn't hear. Now we're going to do, unless somebody else wants to change the schedule.
Cowgirls are playing tonight. So remember, she always sings. Ragging in the cattle at the scene. Back and forth on his saddle on a horse.
Pretty good horse.
That is pink up in the gate.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Very good work today, ladies and gentlemen. Order of business tomorrow will be second reading. We will have, 11 or 12 bills that we did on first reading today. Third reading will be the budget bill. As I understand it, at this point, there are only 12 budget amendments, so don't run right out and file a whole lot more, because then we can get to Committee of the Whole, which will be Senate Files 9, 115, 55, 91, 65, 100, and the rest of the bills on the list that will be passed out. With that, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until 10 a.m. tomorrow, February 17th, 2011.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The House will stand adjourned until Thursday, February 16th, 2011, 10 a.m.